This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We've just finished our January 2019 print edition of The Trumpet that is posting to the website, thetrumpet.com, this week. One feature story in this issue looks into the question, how vulnerable is the United States to cyber attack? A recent Bloomberg report alleged that China's army is preparing for widespread attacks on America's military and economy, having manufactured microchips that give them backdoor access into computers that are being used by the U.S. Department of Defense, NASA, both houses of Congress, Navy warships, and other critical operations. Quite an incendiary report. It was disputed, but that is really only part of considerable evidence of Chinese efforts to use hacking as a weapon of war against America. And there's quite a lot of prophecy in the Bible that indicates how successful those efforts may well be. So we're going to start with a report from Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about this important subject. We'll follow that with a report from Callum Wood about this past weekend's APEC summit. It's another arena where China is exhibiting considerable muscle. In country after country, China is building infrastructure and making major economic investments that end up indebting those nations to China, which gives China leverage to extract concessions and to extend its power. And this trend is reshaping the map of Asia and beyond, and it's doing it in a way that fulfills critical Bible prophecy. For our third segment, we'll get an interesting perspective on the fall of the Berlin Wall. We just passed the anniversary of that event on November 9th. We're going to hear from our station manager, Dwight Falk, about how the people of East Germany don't look back on that event in quite the positive way that we in the West have been led to believe or would think that they would. Their attitudes shed some interesting light on prophecies of what will happen politically in Germany in the near future. And I'll conclude with a last word about the importance of being thankful. We'll start, though, by looking at evidence of China's cyber attacks on America in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
Bloomberg Businessweek published a bombshell report last month saying that microchips, tiny microchips about the size of a grain of rice, were secretly planted on numerous server motherboards made by the California-based hardware manufacturer Supermicro. The report said the chips were secretly added to Supermicro's motherboards at factories operated by manufacturing subcontractors in China. And the specific individuals who added these chips were Chinese operatives with direct links to the Chinese military. They were part of a People's Liberation Army unit specializing in hardware attacks. Bloomberg said the chips were placed on the motherboards in locations that would allow hackers to remotely alter how the device functioned line by line, however they wanted, leaving no one the wiser. And then it said, quote, deviously small changes could create disastrous effects. And this report was major news because Supermicro's products have been used by about 30 U.S. companies, including Apple and Amazon and some other juggernauts. And Supermicro's products have also been used by the Department of Homeland Security, by both houses of Congress and NASA. And it gets worse. Bloomberg said the compromised hardware, quote, could be found in Department of Defense data centers, the CIA's drone operations, and the onboard networks of Navy ships, end quote. This is stunning because not only were the hackers able to strike these U.S. military targets, but they were able to do it with hardware hacks, not just software, which is what is targeted in most hacks. The report really emphasizes how remarkable that is. It says, quote, this attack was something graver than the software-based incidents the world has grown accustomed to seeing. Hardware hacks are more difficult to pull off and potentially more devastating, promising the kind of long-term stealth access that spy agencies are willing to invest millions of dollars and many years to get, end quote. It's important to note that Apple, Amazon, Supermicro, and Homeland Security have all refuted the Bloomberg report. And of course, the Chinese government has denied the allegations against it. But even if this particular report remains unconfirmed, it's far from the only time that companies with links to the Chinese government have come under scrutiny by the U.S. for similar activities. Last May, the Pentagon suddenly issued a sweeping ban on all phones built by Chinese manufacturers ZTE and Huawei on U.S. military bases. The reason for the ban wasn't given, but the immediacy and severity with which it went into effect suggested something sinister. And then there are also ongoing congressional investigations right now into Facebook regarding their data sharing with Huawei. And a similar investigation is underway with Google. In all of these scenarios, and in so many more, the concern is America's national security. Last month, the Government Accountability Office published an alarming report saying that nearly all weapons systems that were being developed by U.S. defense sources from 2012 to 2017 are vulnerable to cyber attacks. So this is the weaponry and the systems that we depend on for national security, and yet nearly all of it that was published during those years is vulnerable to cyber attack. On October 5th, John Bolton, who leads the U.S. National Security Council, talked about this danger and said, quote, "Chinese efforts to threaten us in cyberspace and across the information technology spectrum are a high priority for us." So there are efforts being made to counter China's attacks on America's cyber technology, but some experts say that since the U.S. is so dependent on computer technologies with supply chains linked to China, such threats are something that America just has to learn to live with. On October 6th, the CEO of Luta Security essentially said this. She said, "I think we've already kind of passed the point where we can, for national security, just insource everything. I think we've passed that point at least 30 years ago." So she's basically saying it's too late for the U.S. to fix its cyber vulnerability, even those vulnerabilities that jeopardize our national security. And instead, we should just be ready for that vulnerability to be exploited. America's cyber vulnerability really is very alarming, and it's something that has been on the radar of Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury for more than 20 years now. He first wrote about this danger back in 1995, warning about the danger specifically of the American military of being too dependent on computer systems that are vulnerable to sabotage by terrorists and other enemies. In an article at that time, Mr. Fleury quoted analyst Joseph DeCourcy, who called this dependence the Western world's Achilles heel. And Mr. Fleury wrote, quote, "America is the greatest superpower this world has ever known, but we have a very vulnerable point in our military, our own Achilles heel. It is so dangerous that I'm amazed it hasn't received more publicity," end quote. Mr. Fleury went on from there to say that studying into the Western world's cyber vulnerability made him think of a Bible prophecy recorded in Ezekiel chapter 7. Verses 1 through 3 of the chapter show that it is a message from God to the land of Israel in the end time. And this is referring mainly to the United States and Britain in the modern era. For any listeners who would like to prove this profound truth for yourself, I would encourage you to order and study our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, which we'll have a link to in the show notes. But it is clear that Ezekiel 7 is describing a future time when God will punish the United States and the UK for their abominations and for their rejection of his law and authority. Verse 8 makes that plain. And then verse 14 describes one certain aspect of that punishment. It says, quote, "They have blown the trumpet, even to make all ready, but none goes to the battle." So this is an alarming prophecy. It's about a future time when U.S. military technology will have been apparently hijacked by enemies. And Mr. Fleury wrote this about it. "It seems everybody is expecting our people to go into battle, but the greatest tragedy imaginable occurs. Nobody goes to battle, even though the trumpet is blown. Will it be because of a computer terrorist?" And then there's also a passage in Isaiah 59 that provides more details about the same future time of calamity in the U.S. and Britain. In verses 9 and 10, the people of America and Britain are shown to be stripped of vision. It says, quote, "We wait for light, but behold obscurity. We wait for brightness, but we walk in darkness. We grope for the wall like the blind, and we grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday as in the night. We are in desolate places as dead men." End quote. This passage certainly has a spiritual application. It's plain to see already that these nations are in great spiritual darkness and blindness. But the passage may well also have a specific physical fulfillment. After computer networks of vital government institutions and agencies are ravaged by China and other enemy nations, the computer-reliant populations would be in the dark. The military would be flying blind. This is a dark and disturbing picture of the near future, and there are several other Bible passages that point to this same sobering future time. So when we see China's cyber assaults on U.S. technologies, such as the one that was disclosed by that recent Bloomberg report, we should really see that as the fulfillment of biblical prophecies that were written thousands of years ago. The Bible is proving true. It's proving to be an authority that we can trust and that we must trust. And it's also important to know that the Bible doesn't stop with these grim prophecies. The same Bible that has accurately predicted the cyber attacks that we're now seeing also predicts an event of far greater importance, the return of Jesus Christ. All of the bad news that's unfolding around the world today makes the powerful case, though most don't realize it, that the world needs a different type of government. It shows that the governments of the West and the East alike are failing. It shows that we need a drastically better form of government, and the Bible makes clear that when he returns, Christ will bring in a system of governance with him that's infinitely superior to anything mankind is capable of devising. Global catastrophe is looming, but the same Bible that has proven itself trustworthy says Jesus Christ will interrupt the worldwide crisis. He'll bring godly governance with him, and he'll usher in an age of stability, peace, and prosperity for all countries and peoples.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. There was one quote that you gave in there from a security expert that I just found quite extraordinary, where essentially she said there's nothing that we can do about this, that the United States has become so dependent on these technologies, we can't afford to wean ourselves off of them in order to secure ourselves. So they're essentially betting that the cost of insourcing these technologies would be higher than the costs of having foreign nations able to hack into these computer systems. It just seems like phenomenal naivety.
I completely agree. I think that is really alarming. It's almost an inevitable consequence of globalization.
Right.
Because we outsource everything and we're able to get it so much more affordably because we have a lot of our manufacturing done in nations like China. But of course, the downside when you're talking about technologies that we depend on for national security, mm-hmm. letting them be built in part or whole by these nations that long to see the end of the era of American dominance, that just comes with a whole host of problems. And it really seems like whatever the expense would be to ensure that those kinds of things are made domestically, we should be spending that money because it's just too dangerous to outsource parts of this very sensitive security.
It's a very practical manifestation of the prioritization of, say, economic prosperity or being able to get things for the cheapest rate you can versus higher considerations. So in the report, you mentioned that Apple and Amazon and some of these other countries disputed the Bloomberg report, and that really was the kind of what got the ball rolling on this topic, because that Bloomberg report was quite a damning and shocking report in a lot of ways. How much, just looking into this, were you able to discern what was the cause of those companies' objections? How valid were those?
Well, it's a little bit difficult to say because just about everyone who went on or who spoke with Bloomberg did so on the condition of anonymity. These are people who are in, you know, apparently in high positions in those companies with Apple, the Department of Defense, so on and so forth, and they didn't want to go on record with their name. So because of that, it's
hard to verify the Bloomberg. There's no collaborative or there's no corroborative reporting behind what Bloomberg did.
From what I've seen, there hasn't yet been, but we do know that in around 2016, Apple really suddenly got rid of hundreds and hundreds of Supermicro motherboards in a lot of their products. And these are almost in like supercomputers. So to replace all of those suddenly and inexplicably, they didn't offer an explanation as to why, but it would have been at a colossal expense. And a lot of those who believe that the Bloomberg report is true, they say, why would Apple have done that if there wasn't a reason for them to have been concerned?
So at that time, I suppose there would have been speculation that there must have been some kind of compromised element within those motherboards, but it wasn't really until the Bloomberg report that we kind of got a sense of just how extensive this is and the reach into some of these critical government agencies as well.
That's right, yes. At the time, I believe Apple was very vague about it, just, you know, we're doing upgrades. But in retrospect, with this Bloomberg report having emerged, it looks suspicious.
So the tendency in human nature, I guess, within the officials that you're describing, the security experts, to kind of want to assume everything is going to work out okay and just push this off the day of reckoning that we may face over this. I think that's kind of the way that we all tend to think. We all have that tendency is that we don't want to we don't want to think the worst. We want to hope for the best. But it's interesting, this subject, it doesn't get covered a whole lot. We've talked about it, you know, from time to time in the trumpet over the years. But the Bible's prophecies about America's fall are so clear, and there are so many of them. And you look at how strong the United States is in so many ways, just how dominant it is economically. Its military spending exceeds all other nations, you know, by a massive margin. Technological superiority. You know, the idea that this superpower would fall almost seems impossible. And yet, when you look at this subject and say some of the prophecies that you brought out in the report, that you bring out in the article that you wrote in the Trumpet magazine that's coming up, it does give you an idea of how some of that, or a considerable measure of that superiority, could be eliminated and wiped out just overnight, basically.
That's exactly right. And I think that it's really telling that Mr. Fleury focused on the, you know, the Greek mythological hero Achilles, because it's such a perfect analogy for what we see happening. America is incredibly powerful. And in Greek mythology, this hero was basically impervious to harm everywhere, except for these tiny little places on his heels, where he hadn't received some sort of protection. But it really is an amazing analogy for the mighty United States with our military that really seems like it couldn't be touched. But yet we have these vulnerabilities that are hidden. We don't even know where they all may be. But they if you look at those Bible prophecies, it really looks like they will compromise our strength.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about China using hacking as a weapon against the United States. He has an article in the coming print edition of The Trumpet. This is the January 2019 edition. The name of the article, China Hacks America and None Goes to Battle. That's in reference to a specific Bible prophecy that this could very well fulfill. This edition of The Trumpet is posting online this week. You can read that at thetrumpet.com, including this article from Jeremiah. We appreciate your time very much.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
This past Sunday concluded a summit of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. This is a forum for 21 nations around the Pacific Rim. It promotes free trade throughout the Asia-Pacific. Well, this year the group was unable to produce a unified statement at the end of the summit. Many analysts said that it marked a real failure for the group. But Trumpet writer Callum Wood says there's more to the story. To talk about this, we have him on the line from down in Australia. Hello, Callum.
Hello, sir. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's good to hear from you again. So tell us what the aims of the summit were going in.
Well, the aims of the summit generally revolve around a number of issues facing nations in Southeast Asia, the Pacific. Oftentimes, the smaller nations, particularly the smaller island nations, want to focus on things like global warming, rising sea levels, which obviously for an island nation that only sits a few meters above sea level is a much greater threat than it is to larger and more mountainous nations. But also there's a lot of economic deals that go back and forth. A lot of planning and preparations go into APEC to see that nations build stronger bilateral relations, economic ties, and particularly because the United States, China, Australia, and these larger nations are all members, and a lot of them do want to develop closer ties to the smaller nations in and around the Pacific.
Okay. So you say, despite the fact that they weren't able to agree on any kind of a joint statement at the end, that the reality is China actually came out pretty good. Maybe you can just describe what you mean by that.
Absolutely. Well, yes, if you were a diplomat from China, or Mr. Xi Jinping himself, he attended this summit. Walking away, I'm sure he would be very happy. China walked away from that a clear victor, and they certainly established themselves as the regional powerhouse. And now the reason for this is, while despite they came to a lot of disagreements with America, they did walk away a clear winner in the eyes of the other member nations. This came out in a number of comments, particularly from the host nation, Papua New Guinea, and there the finance minister and a number of others spoke about how they agreed with what China had been saying at the meeting, more than they had agreed with Mike Pence, who was there representing the United States. And also China was able to secure yet another nation for its Belt and Road Initiative. And the Trumpet's spoken a lot about this Belt and Road Initiative, China's multi-billion-dollar economic plan to boost trade and to link its trade with nations throughout the Pacific, all the way across, stretching all the way to Europe. And at this meeting, China pitched the idea to 8 nations in the APEC forum. And this wasn't, of course, officially part of APEC. It was more of a side deal that China was working on. And of these 8 nations, one nation of Tonga actually signed up there on the spot and said, yes, we'll be a part of it. And in return, China basically wiped a lot of their debts that they did owe to China at the time. And that really does highlight a policy that China has been working on to bring nations into its sphere of influence. It's a matter of using debt as a means of taking nation sovereignty or forcing them into trade alliances and drawing them away from the United States.
Okay, so this is something that China has been doing with several nations. In this article that you have put together that's going up on thetrumpet.com, you specifically talk about the relationship that it's developing with Papua New Guinea, the host country for the APEC summit. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's really fascinating. Papua New Guinea is just the case in point. It's the perfect example of how this system of coercion works for Beijing. Papua New Guinea is, while it's very mineral rich, it's a very resource rich nation. The fishing industry there has so much potential. The nation is really crippled by corruption. The government is very weak. There's a lot of infighting, political intrigue, and also a lot of problems with the military and the police forces there. And so the nation does receive a lot of aid from outside sources. And the biggest of these is, of course, Australia, which over the years has given millions upon millions of dollars to the Papua New Guinea government for projects. Now, these projects always come with certain strings attached. Australia likes the projects to be things that are going to not only benefit Papua New Guinea, hospitals, roads, infrastructure, that sort of thing. They also obviously want it to benefit Australia and certainly build the relationship between the two. So Australia does tend to dictate where that aid goes. Now, China, on the other hand, has no such qualms. They give to Papua New Guinea, not as much as Australia does, but it doesn't come with any apparent strings attached to it. And what I mean by that is in the lead up to this APEC summit, Papua New Guinea wanted to update a lot of their facilities. So China invested $16 million in a stretch of road that's just 1 kilometer long, less than a mile for our friends in America. $16 million to build a 1 kilometer long, six-lane highway that extends from the Parliament building, 1 kilometer down the road where it eventually just peters off into main public roads like you see throughout Port Moresby. So they invested $16 million in this, and everyone calls it the road to nowhere, which is really what it is. It's just China giving all this money to the Papua New Guinea government and the government then using it for very frivolous and unnecessary spends. And there was an even better example than that. In the lead up, China gave money to the government again, who then went out and they bought a fleet of 40 Maseratis and 3 Bentleys. And just in case we have any car enthusiasts out there, the Maseratis here in Australia for one of those would sell for more than $200,000.
That's an important government expenditure there.
So China invested a lot of money in that.
Yeah. So China is so cash rich, and they're throwing a lot of money around to a lot of these, a lot of different nations, extending their influence into these areas. And it really does seem like they're taking advantage of the developing world in a lot of cases. Especially be attracted to areas that have a lot of resources but don't necessarily have a very stable government or have some of the limitations that you were describing regarding Papua New Guinea. What's the quid pro quo for their side? You said there are no apparent strings attached, but just talk about what China does receive in return for some of the investments they're making.
Well, that's right. It does pay dividends. China is not doing this out of any just concern for these nations or out of their love and outgoing affection. No, China wants something from this arrangement. And what often happens across the region, we see China saddles these nations with all sorts of debts. They give them loans that they know these nations can't repay. Often these nations are quite impoverished, though they are resource rich, like Papua New Guinea. And China knows that they aren't going to be able to pay back these debts. Now, Australia and other nations know this as well. But when Papua New Guinea or whichever this nation is that's loaned the money, whenever they default or they can't pay their debts on time, Australia doesn't ask them to give up anything in return. China does. And that's what we see across the region, everywhere, even in Australia, Sri Lanka, other places. We see China invests heavily in these projects. Oftentimes it's ports or airports, roads, infrastructure, power plants, these sort of things. We see China invest a lot of money in it. The nation can't pay it back. And so China says, well, hey, give us control of it for 100 years and we'll wipe the debt. Mm. And oftentimes these nations don't have much other alternative. They, as I said, they can't pay back the debts to China. And so in exchange, they're happy to just have the debt wiped clean and give control to China. And that's why we see China expanding what it calls the String of Pearls, a lot of deep sea ports that stretch across the Indian Ocean. In Sri Lanka, the Trumpet's reported on that repeatedly. We even see Australia's not immune. The port of Darwin on our northern coastline there has been given to China for 99 years. And these sort of moves are because all of these nations across the Pacific are saddled with Chinese debt. And it gives Beijing incredible leverage to say, hey, we're calling in on a favor now. We've given you this money. We've supplied you with this facility or that facility. You haven't paid us back. Okay, here's the deal. We want control and you'll give it to us.
Yeah. So essentially it's purchasing these high value ports throughout these areas, and really attaining a certain geostrategic and geopolitical control over these strategically important areas throughout Asia and beyond. And the flip side of that is this is really a strategy that doesn't have a good answer. Just from the West's perspective, they don't have the kind of money to throw around that China does. And so even if it were a matter of trying to offer a sweeter deal to some of these places, if it had the inclination, it doesn't have the means.
Absolutely. That's right. And a lot of the nations that are big donors in the region, Australia, for instance, we give a lot of money to foreign nations in foreign aid. And yet at the same time, we borrow millions upon millions of dollars from China ourselves. So as you said, we can't outgive them. And what this just leads to is the fulfillment of some incredible Bible prophecies about the rise of China and other Asian nations in the region. And it also brings them all together, fulfilling a secondary prophecy as well, which the trumpeters often talked about, which is called the Mart of Nations.
So tell us about that, the Mart of Nations.
So this Mart of Nations, it's discussed in Isaiah 22 and 23, and it talks about this rising power block that does include a series of Asian nations, including one called Chittim. Now, Chittim is the ancient name for China, and we have a number of articles on the Trumpet website that explain this, and we might have a link in the show notes to point readers to it if they would like to read more about that. And this power block, it forms this incredible economic power, which of course does eventually become a military power as well. But it forms as this economic power. And so when we see China expanding its reach across the Southeast Asia and Pacific, drawing in a lot of island nations, we can just see them building this trade route, linking itself with the resource-rich parts of the region. We see them acquiring the ports. We see them acquiring the roads. Here in Australia, for instance, you can even see it happening. China owns the big farms, the biggest dairy farm in Australia down in Tasmania. They own the farm. They have the laborers. They own the trucks that take it to a Chinese-owned port where they put the produce on Chinese-owned ships which sail across the ocean to the ports in China. We can see them establishing this trade route, which is one day going to fuel an incredible, amazing, actually, power that is prophesied in the Bible, that this power is so big it fields a 200 million man army. And you can read about that, of course, in the book of Revelation. But we can see here that China is preparing for that, laying the groundwork to have an army of that size. It won't just be China. It'll have to be other nations included, which we know of as the kings of the East. But to fuel this army and to fuel this power, it's going to need food. It's going to need resources. It's going to need the things that these smaller Pacific islands today can offer.
We were talking earlier in the program to Jeremiah Jacques about China's aggressiveness in coming after the United States with cyber attacks, and how the United States has really made itself vulnerable by relying on technology so much, and in many cases, Chinese manufactured technology. And there's a certain naivety associated with that America is conducting its business as if it doesn't have to pay a price in the long run, that it's willing to secure these short-term advantages for, say, cheaper technology at the very high long-term cost of opening itself up to foreign attack. And it's like there's a certain failure to imagine that another country would come after it in ways that could be actually catastrophic to the nation. And in a sense, this is the same story in a different arena, that you have a failure on the part of the United States in particular to recognize the severity of the threat that's coming from China, as China is laying brick by brick this edifice that could have devastating economic effects on the United States. The prophecy is what tells us how that's going to end.
Absolutely. And I think that some in America are starting to wake up to it in a way. I know that Mike Pence, while he was at APEC, was pleading with nations, don't saddle yourselves with Chinese debt. It just leads to forfeiting sovereignty. But a lot of these nations are already locked in. I mean, it almost seems like for America, it's too little too late.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to encourage everybody to go to thetrumpet.com and read this article by Callum Wood, China's APEC Victory. We'll also put links to a few other articles in the show notes on this program. We have one, Is China in the Bible? It explains the origins of China in biblical prophecy, the descendants of China that go back to prophecies that are recorded in the Bible that Callum mentioned earlier. We also have a trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches the Rise of China as a Superpower. We've been talking with trumpet writer Callum Wood about how China is undertaking these economic conquests throughout Asia. He has an article, China's APEC Victory, that spells it all out. You can check that out at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, Callum.
Thanks for having me on the show.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
November 9th, 1989, the Berlin Wall fell. The division between West Germany and Soviet-occupied East Germany ended, and it was widely viewed as a victory for freedom. But intriguingly, many East Germans didn't see it as entirely positive, as we will now hear in this report from Dwight Falk.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
On a recent Trumpet Daily radio show, host Stephen Fleury cited a report that 40% of East Germans think a dictator would be good in certain circumstances. Now, those are alarming numbers, especially since East Germany was ruled by the former Soviet Union from the end of World War II until the Berlin Wall came down in 1989. Of all people, wouldn't East Germans despise dictatorial rule? How do East Germans feel about their history behind the wall and their reunification with West Germany? You might be surprised. Author Christopher Hilton interviewed a variety of East Germans for his 2008 book, After the Berlin Wall, Putting Two Germanies Back Together Again. The attitude of the majority of those interviewed is that things weren't so bad in East Germany. In fact, they feel some things were better than they are today. Hilton asked this question of former East German police officer Frank Thomas. If you had a magic wand to go back to November 8th, 1989, what would you do with that magic wand? That's difficult to say, Thomas said. The social structures that we had, the care for children and so on, they were wonderful. We had hardly any unemployed people. The doctors were free of charge. The social background for the young people was better. We had the youth clubs. All that has gone. And a few others that were interviewed had similar sentiments. They missed certain aspects of the way it was in East Germany before the wall fell. But as a police officer, Thomas has seen an increase in a few things that he does not like, including crime. He said burglaries increased. And it was completely new dealing with drugs. We had no drugs in East Germany. The police force from East Germany was taken over by the West after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Another former East German officer, who was identified by the alias Raymond, said the police administration became more bureaucratic. And many in the East were frustrated by the fact that the West simply took over. There was very little collaboration. And the people from East Germany hoped that there would be more of a collaborative effort in reunification. The frustration over this takeover and the added bureaucracy was especially felt in the financial sector. Professor Dr. Norbert Walter was chief economist at the Deutsche Bank Group, and he said that 15 million East Germans had to accept a complicated bureaucratic system with which they were not familiar and for which they did not have the necessary advisors. All of a sudden, they were exposed to capitalism, and they weren't used to it. The citizens of East Germany needed tax accountants, they needed lawyers, and they also needed financial advisors. The fall of the wall brought the opportunity to buy more and more, and you could use credit to do it, something that was not common in East Germany. Marion Drogsler is a former East German history teacher who lost her job after reunification. But she now works for an organization that helps the unemployed. And she said it was hardly possible to get into debt in East Germany. Credit wasn't readily available or used very often. Now, but after the wall fell, it was too much, she said. People were not able to decide what they really needed. After reunification, many East Germans lost their jobs, their identity, and their history. The educational system and teaching of history was completely taken over by the West. And again, that frustrated many East German teachers. Dr. Falk Pingel of the George Eckhart Institute for International Textbook Research said this: "The publishers quickly brought out new books, but they were just new editions of the ones written in the West in the 1980s. With an added chapter on reunification. It wasn't at all representative of the idea the East Germans had of their own history. The repressive nature of the communist regime was emphasized. Reunification was presented as a positive thing without mentioning the dashed hopes and dreams of the East. Many in East Germany have experienced their lives being turned upside down. Everything that they had known changed. And it changed overnight. When all the major institutions were taken over by the West, East Germans felt that, quote, so many aspects of unification involved what appeared to be a settling of scores, according to the author of the book, Christopher Hilton. They felt that it was the West getting back at the East. With life more complex, more uncertain, and more bureaucratic than ever, many East Germans long for the stability of the past. Not that they want to go back to the way it was before the wall fell, but they're also not eagerly embracing the democracy of the West. About 40% of East Germans, according to the report on the recent Trumpet Daily Radio Show, would submit to a dictator to regain their stability. German history shows that the German people are often willing to throw their support behind a powerful leader. And Daniel 8 prophesies of a strong man to come on the scene in the very near future. A former East German schoolteacher said this: "Only recently we went to the cinema with the pupils to see a film about an American teacher applying fascist methods in school. The pupils think this is good and normal, a kind of experiment that works. Could this happen again, like the Third Reich? 20 years ago, I'd have said no," she said. "But now I think it is possible."
Thank you very much for that, Dwight.
You're welcome.
Very interesting perspective, and you can sympathize with these East Germans who you're just talking about essentially completely transforming your way of life overnight and having quite a lot of things that certainly there were many East Germans who were oppressed, who were eager to have some of the restrictions on their lives lifted. But this idea that essentially what was an alien way of life that was kind of imposed on them wholly, and that there would have been things that they would, you know, the education, the elements of government having taken care of this and that, that were suddenly stripped from them, you could see where there would be a backlash to that.
Yeah, they definitely wanted to travel in a lot of cases and see the rest of the world and have some of those freedoms. They were intrigued by the fact that you could buy more things in the West. You could buy fruit that wasn't in season or grown locally, things like that. They enjoyed that, but they didn't want to give up everything they had known either. And the point that keeps being brought out in these interviews in this book is that they were hoping it would be more of a collaborative process. Like, we can take some of what we like from the West, but we'll keep a lot of what we like. And when the West came in, they just took over everything. And it left a lot of the East Germans in a position where they didn't know how to deal with the West system. And again, everything they had known, I mean, if they had lived there their whole lives, which some of them had, to have that completely gone, it's a very, well, as they said, it dashed some of their hopes and dreams.
Mm. Well, you know, I listening to this in the context of what's happening globally and even within Europe right now, where you have clear trend toward populations and voting populations who want leaders with more power. And there's a certain movement away from the uncertainties that the democratic norms of the Western world have tended to have accompanied, and looking more for strongman leadership. It seems like these attitudes that you're describing in East Germany, in a sense, there's a resonance here, even with those nations, even among those nations that haven't experienced the kind of authoritarianism that the East Germans did. And you can see maybe there would be a lot more Europeans who would look at this and say, you know, have a certain yearning for exactly the kind of strong government control that they did have at one time.
Yeah, a lot of those that were in East Germany, they were frustrated by the bureaucracy that came with the West. And then also, they just had more to worry about in the sense of you have more decisions to make. Mm-hmm. And some of them were very comfortable with the government makes most of your decisions for you, mm-hmm. and you plod through life. But you know what to expect, even though it's not, you don't have this chance to really say, gain a lot more wealth or those types of things. But they were comfortable with just the norms of stability. And so now, especially when you factor in all of the immigration that's come into Europe and right. into Germany in particular, that adds a whole nother dimension. Because the sense that I get from some of the interviews that they did, and again, they also do talk a little bit about the generation that's younger, that didn't live behind the wall, and they don't see it the same way. But I think what they all have in common is that they want a system, but I don't think they want the West system.
Right.
It's not that they want to go back and be under Russia's, you know, mm-hmm. boot, but they don't love what's happening with, see, Angela Merkel now and this influx of these migrants. And so they're longing, the East Germans in particular, especially the older ones, are longing for identity. Mm-hmm. Like, who are we as a nation and as a people? And I think that's what they're sort of grappling with. And so when you see statistics come out saying 40% of East Germans think maybe a dictator would be okay.
Right.
I think they're longing. It's not like they're saying we want Hitler to come back.
No.
But they do want a system that is their system. And I don't think they want the West system.
Right. And I mean, obviously they wouldn't gravitate toward, you know, they wouldn't say outright, well, we need a Hitler. But you could see how they would be very supportive if the right man came along who put the right face on it. When you look at the kind of instability that you have in Western nations, you look at what's happening in Britain right now, and you look at what's happening in the United States, and just the chaos that comes from a political system that is essentially founded on opposition, opposing parties going after each other, and there's a lot of division in these countries. And you even see the kind of problems that you have in Germany under a system where you have a leader that's been trying to uphold more of those democratic norms. You could see where the right man comes along and says, I can fix this. You see the way that it's happening in Russia. You see the way it's happening in China. You see the support for somebody like Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey. And the fact that this is exactly what is prophesied to happen in Germany and in Europe, it gives you a sense of just how easy it would be for this to happen.
Yeah, and it's interesting also in relation to like the way they're looking at their own history there in East Germany, because the people that are coming up now through school, it's a very open system of history. In other words, they're not teaching one truth on it. Like, this government is good, this government is bad. It's sort of a, well, what do you like, what do you think? And so just the educational system even is leading into some of what you were talking about. They're like, well, maybe some of these ideas aren't so bad. You know, maybe we could have a little bit of fascism, not that they'd call it that probably, but they're being taught to sort of look for another way or another path, mm-hmm. because they're not being given a very specific, you know, here were the evils of communism or the evils of any other government, and here are the virtues of the West.
Yeah.
And so when you see the rise of strong people, strong leaders all over the world, I think it's just natural and for them to say, well, where's our identity? Where's our leader to, you know, put our hat in the ring and deal with the global situation?
I would encourage listeners to go read Gerald Flory's booklet that he put out on A Strong German Leader is Imminent. It puts this into context with the Bible prophecies that Dwight alluded to there at the end of his report, Daniel 8 and others. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. It's there in the literature tab, and we'll put it in the show notes for today's program. But we've been talking with Trumpet Radio station manager Dwight Falk about the attitudes of East Germans toward the reunification of Germany. Very interesting. You can keep your eye on thetrumpet.com for how these attitudes will play out in German politics. It was something we really need to keep our eyes on. We appreciate your time, Dwight.
You're welcome.
It's time for today's last word.
God pays close attention to many anniversaries, memorials, and annual reminders. The Sabbath after Thanksgiving is one date I remember each year. It was on this day in 1994 that my family attended services with the Philadelphia Church of God for the first time. So I've been in the PCG for well over two decades, more than half my life, the previous years being in the Worldwide Church of God. A full human lifetime is only seven or eight decades, so two decades is a pretty decent portion of a life. Reflecting on this inspires overwhelming gratitude for the blessings of these past two decades. I can survey over two decades of being baptized, possessing and growing in the Holy Spirit, the source of spiritual understanding and power and love. Over two decades now of working at headquarters in Edmond, directly contributing to God's work. About two decades of marriage, building memories and absorbing all the lessons that that offers. Nearly two decades in God's ministry and teaching at God's college, helping others' spiritual growth. Approaching two decades as a father, over a decade as a father of three, working together in partnership with God and my wife at shaping future God beings. It's a marvelous education. When God begets someone with his spirit and brings him into his family, he is so generous with opportunities to learn and grow. Developing a relationship with God through daily prayer, continually striving to make it more spirit-minded, godlier, more vigorous, and robust. Learning the skills, the workmanship of productive Bible study, coming to accept the piercing of God's spiritual sword into the joints and marrow. Learning to convert words and stories and abstractions into redirected thoughts and words and deeds. seeking biblical guidance to answer life's questions, to speak to one's need and the needs of the family, building relationships within the body of Christ, being sharpened by the iron of Christian fellowship, learning to serve and sacrifice and love, developing a relationship with Christ's ministry, recognizing direction, seeking counsel, accepting correction. These are the courses of a character-building curriculum. They really are true blessings. It is sweet and bitter and awe-inspiring to think of the faces that have come and gone over these years, as well as those that have remained, dedicated, immovable fixtures within the family throughout that time. God's supreme feat of creative accomplishment is to forge His holy character within a spirit-begotten individual, and to have witnessed more than two decades of that miraculous, intense process in countless hundreds, even thousands of lives, has been profoundly impressive. To have known and rubbed shoulders with many dozens illustrious heroes who have completed that course and now await their resurrection to godhood, that's breathtaking to contemplate. Being involved in that supreme, spiritually creative process, acquiescing to the hand of the Creator at work, it's exhilarating. Looking at this with day-to-day perspective, you see stumbles, modest gains, needless setbacks, quiet victories, disheartening frustrations. But you step back and look at two decades, and you can better recognize God's creative handiwork. Fruits appear. The greater focus in work, good habits, edging out bad ones, deeper love for God's law and word, sharper discernment of Satan's devices and broadcasts, keener appreciation for what's truly important in life, clearer perspective on and even gratitude for challenges and trials, and genuine joy in teaching and rearing children and sharing God's truth, greater intimacy in worship. Too slowly, but bit by incremental bit, the supplanting of hypocrisy with single-mindedness, sincerity, truth. All credit goes to the husbandman. He truly is relentless in his effort to produce fruit within his children. Within the heart of every last begotten son who will yield to him, he never ceases to work away, pressing, prodding, softening, molding, toiling, hammering, healing. And because of his pity, his persistence, his perseverance, and his unending patience, over time, over decades, his efforts repay. He keeps incrementally gaining ground in his supreme feat of creative accomplishment. In the grander scheme, the last two decades have witnessed an overwhelming amount of failure among the people of God. But the Father does not give up. And within His faithful remnant, the luster of God's truth and the brightness of God's presence have steadily grown because the wonders of His work have grown. For two decades, God has continually revealed more, expanding our understanding and enlarging our vision. And it's only been the beginning. Exciting new initiatives are starting all the time. God always fixes our eyes on the horizon. Where will we be in just another short decade? It promises to be brighter than any before. A world transformed. For that, I am thankful. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques, Callum Wood, and Dwight Falk. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Jesse Hester. I'll leave you with this thought from Cicero. Gratitude is not only the greatest of virtues, but the parent of all the others. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.